All right, we're in Leviticus chapter 17 to 20, as we're slated to deal with that in our study this evening. And we're fast getting through the book of Leviticus, and here in a couple of weeks or so, we'll be getting into the book of Numbers, and that'll be our study for this trimester. Anyway, this is our outline of where we are, and where we are, what we're dealing with. We're in the miscellaneous laws section, and dealing with heathen customs that are forbidden, chapters 17 through 18, as this outline presents it in Laws of Holiness, 19 and 20. That'll be our section for tonight. As per Wiersbe, we're in the Holy Nation section of God's precepts for separation and purity. We'll see that separation described a little bit in detail in our study tonight. Let's go over our chapters that we've been through, our 16 chapters. Chapter 1 dealt with burnt offering. Chapter 2, grain offering. Chapter 3, the peace offering. 4, sin offering. And 5, trespass offering and restitution. That continues in chapter 6. What else in chapter 6? More offerings. And then chapter 7 brings that section to a close. Offering and the eating of blood. Now, we're going to see more about blood in our study tonight in chapter 17. Well, that's primarily the sections on offering. So chapter 8 dealt with what? Consecration of Aaron and his sons. And then we have in 9, initiated into the office, the beginning of their work of priesthood. Something tragic in chapter 10. Nadab and Abihu. And then chapter 11, clean and unclean animals. Chapter 12, purification of a woman after childbirth. Chapter 13, law concerning leprosy. Chapter 14 continues cleansing of the leper. Very good. Chapter 15, bodily discharges, bodily uncleanness, and then chapter 16, a notable chapter, Day of Atonement. All right, chapter 17, what's it about? All right, sacrifice at the tabernacle and blood. What's chapter 18 about? Various laws pertaining to morality, sexual laws. Chapter 19. More various laws that primarily focus on relationships. And then chapter 20, sins that require death or capital punishment. We'll get to all of that here in a second. All right, here's a summary of these four chapters that we're going to be covering in our study. Chapter 17 deals with the sacrifice at the tabernacle, not away from the tabernacle, and or at least to be brought to the tabernacle, and then the sanctity of blood. That's an important chapter to remember. There are key chapters, not that any chapter is unimportant, but like chapter 16, the Day of Atonement, you'll remember that for a long time. And then chapter 17, you always need to remember the sanctity of blood. You'll come back to that again and again and again, even when we're in the New Testament. Chapter 18 deals with sexual laws. Chapter 19, the various laws, primarily, though not completely and solely, deal with relationships. And then chapter 20, sins that require death. Is that making sense? So if you don't have answers to question number 1, there's your answer to that. Question number 2, where were the animal sacrifices to be offered? Verses 1 to 9, chapter 17. Or where were they to be brought? To the door of the tabernacle of meeting. All right, we have some ground to cover, so let's get underway with chapter 17. Chapter 17, 1 to 9, is one thought, and then basically the rest of the chapter, 10 to 16, is another thought, and we could combine those last two points into one, I think, but be that as it may, we'll see more about some of that in just a second. But beginning at verse 2 of chapter 1, or verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses, and he said, this is the thing that I command. And I take it from this, before we get into a discussion of verses 1 to 9, that perhaps there was a tendency of some to make a sacrifice away from the tabernacle. Does that make sense? And perhaps as we have estimated the number of people, we don't know, there were 600,000 that came out, and that was 600,000 fighting men age 20 and older. And so when you take the other men and women and children, some estimate 2.something million, maybe 2.1, 2.2, 2.4 million. So we don't know the exact number. But let's just take 2 million. You've got 2 million people, and the camp that is scattered for some number of miles around, there was a tendency perhaps implied here, and there is some conjecture, that some are offering their sacrifice over here and some over there because that's more convenient. But be that as it may, I'll leave that for you to decide. You might want to track down some information from Cal and Dalich, whether I agree with them or not. They're worth considering on that point. Anyway, starting at verse 3, that whoever kills an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp and kills it outside the camp, he's to bring it to the door of the tabernacle. I think that's the point being made. If he's making a sacrifice, he's to bring the blood to the door of the tabernacle. That's where it's to be offered. This seems to create a bond of unity. Does that make sense? Whereas, if this one says, I'll make my offering over here at our camp, and another one way over here, we'll make our offering, and another family, maybe we'll just make our family offerings at all of these 12 different places, or maybe 24 different places, or divide the tribes up even further, maybe 48 different places, we have no unity. Does that make sense? So this is creating a bond of unity. Yeah, if you don't have unity, you have division. Look at verse 7. Not only were they to bring that, the priest shall bring and sprinkle, and they shall no more, look at verse 7, offer their sacrifices, the King James and the New King James says, to demons. So what's that talking about? Well, it probably has reference to goat demons, and your English standard will say goat demons. The American standard will say he-goats, and that's the literal rendering of that, more so than demons. And you say, well, what's that about? Well, Romans chapter 1, without our turning there, talked about how the Gentile world had worshipped the creature and all manner of creatures. In other words, they made gods out of creatures and all kinds of beasts. And so did they worship the goat? Well, some of the heathens would worship about any kind of animal. So I take it some influence from some of the heathen culture, maybe in Egypt, or maybe already in the wilderness, have come across some. I'm not sure where they picked that up, but not going to do that anymore. You're not going to play the harlot throughout all the generations. And let's see, what else do we want to pay attention to? And then, say what? Oh yeah, it would be. Then verse 9, they bring it to the door of the tabernacle and he'll be cut off from the people. Now I want to come back to that phrase just for a moment. We're going to see that phrase, cut off from the people, as we've already seen a number of times. It seems to have, almost every time, there may be exceptions, having reference to being cut off in the sense that they're killed or dead. Does that make sense? We'll give you some evidence of that a little bit later on in our chapter 20, I think it is. Now, did this include killing animals for food? That was to be done here, and I don't think so. Colin Dalich thinks that, if I remember correctly on that. But if that was the case, that was changed or released by Deuteronomy 12 and 15. So you might want to flag Deuteronomy 12, 15 in the margin of your text, that killing an animal for food was not to be done, or was not required to be done at the door of the tabernacle. Does that make sense? This was for a sacrifice. All right. Now then, let's shift gears to talk about blood not to be eaten. Why was blood not to be eaten? Because life is in the blood. And so whenever, whether it's you or a sojourner with you, he's not to eat blood. I don't think that means if you had some meat that had is a little red, that's the idea of eating blood. This was a consumption of blood generally practiced as part of idolatry. And so they're consuming blood. But as we see in verses 15 to 17, I think what he's talking about there is the animal needs to be properly bled so that you're not consuming blood. All right. Now here's why. you might underline in three different verses here that life, in verse 11, for life of the flesh is in the blood. Do that again at verse 14, for it is the life of all flesh, its blood sustains its life. So highlight verse 11, verse 14, and at the end of verse 14, for the life of all flesh is in its blood, and whoever eats it shall be cut off. Now again, that phrase we've seen earlier in the book of Leviticus, that phrase means that they're cut off in the sense, not just ostracized from the crowd, but they are killed. And you say, well, that seems kind of extreme. Well, that's what chapter 20 is going to be about. We'll see more about that here in a moment. So, I want to come back to that blood in a moment. Let's go ahead and tie 15 and 16 and wrap the chapter together. I think what 15 and 16, if an animal, he mentions two categories of an animal. If an animal dies naturally or if it's torn by beast and and I'm paraphrasing, and I know this is not the wording there, but I think he's saying that if you consume any of that, that is to be properly bled. It's in that context of this blood. But he mentions that you shall if you do that, you bathe in water and unclean until evening, and they both shall be clean. But if he does not wash, then he shall bear his guilt. In other words, he's going to be guilty of wrongdoing. Let's go back to this principle of life is in the blood. That's the reason Genesis 9:6 for capital punishment. Man is made in the image of God, and whoever sheds man's blood by man shall his blood be shed. So life is in the blood, and he's made in the image of God is the reason God gave for capital punishment. Does that make sense? Because life is in the blood. That's why God required blood sacrifice. So could God have required a sacrifice for sin to atone for sin without blood? Well, what he wanted was something wherein life was given, and this is the reason for blood sacrifice all through the Old Testament. And that's the reason for the perfect blood of Christ. So you may wonder, or have wondered, when you were younger, as I did when I was a kid in Bible class, the teacher would say, or I'd hear preachers say, that Jesus died for our sins, and so he had to die for us to be forgiven. I'm thinking, God could do anything. Why couldn't he just forgive us without? Why did Jesus have to die? Why couldn't God just say, I'm forgive him? Because sin demands a penalty be paid, and the only perfect price to be paid is the life of blood, and the only perfect sinless blood is the blood of Christ. And you say, where do you get that idea? Leviticus 17, life is in the blood. So life was given to pay the price. That makes sense? All right, so that principle is going to come to play when we come to the New Testament. We're going to see the shedding of the blood and the blood brings redemption, etc. It's all going to be rooted in this concept that we learn in Leviticus 17, life is in the blood. And so that has everything to do with capital punishment and the reason for that. All right, any questions on chapter 17? Blood's not to be eaten. Not to be equated if somebody, I don't think this is even talking, while I think verses 15 and 16 are talking about the meat was to be properly bled, I think some have the idea that if you ate a piece of meat, because the principle, by the way, Acts 15 is still true, the forbidding of eating of blood. Read Acts 15, see if you don't find it there. And so I think some have the idea that if you ate a piece of meat and it looks a little bit raw, may or rare, that you're eating blood, and so we gotta cook it more, or I'm vile. That's not the principle. This had to do with consuming of the blood, and it was part of a ritual. It was part of idolatry. Does that make sense? Yes, ma'am. I think that he's talking about being properly bled. You're not consuming or drinking the blood or eating the blood. There may be blood. Every one of us have. If you've eaten meat, you have consumed some blood. I guarantee you. Every one of us, there's been some blood consumed. And so you say, well, how much? Maybe it was only just this micro drop, but we have consumed some. That's not equated with the practice that is being alluded to of consuming and eating of blood. But it's a good question, though. All right, let's go to chapter 18 now. Chapter 18, before we get very far, let's go ahead and get question number 4. What does chapter 18, verse 5 teach? You might want to highlight this verse because you're going to come to this time and again in the New Testament. Say again, I can't hear.
Keeping God's word is the most important thing.
All right, that's true. This is quoted in the New Testament. Do we know the context in which it's quoted? Romans 10, Galatians 3. Well, let's wait till we get to verse 5 then. We'll talk about that. Here's what's going on in chapter 18. I'll call this sexual laws. Are there other things besides sexual laws? Yes. But generally this has to do with sexual laws. God has laws for that. So let's start with verses 1 to 5. His point is don't be influenced by the heathens. And so look beginning at verse 2 or 3. According to the doings of the land of Egypt, where you dwelt, do not do. In other words, don't practice the things you learned and you saw while you were down in Egypt. Well, don't do, and he mentions another place. Canaan, where you are going. Don't do what they did. So don't be influenced by your surroundings, that where you came from out of Egypt, and you're going to Canaan. You're going to have the same kind of corrupt culture. Don't walk according to their ordinances. You shall observe my judgments and my ordinances and walk in them. I am the Lord your God. All right, there's a practical thing there. The world has different standards for morality. Don't be influenced by where you came from or where you're going, but be influenced by the commands of God. Now, verse 5. On a cursory reading of that, as per the flow of the context, we might not get the point that's being made, but we do when we come to the New Testament and see the use that inspired writers made of that. So let's talk about that. You should therefore keep my statutes. In other words, instead of listening to others, keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. Now, notice the wording of that. It didn't say, if you live by my commandments, but he says, if a man does them, does those commandments, he shall live by them. So how was that used in Romans 10 and 15? Galatians 3:20. It was in contrast to the gospel. And the point being made, without us going, we don't have time to go to Romans 10 and develop the whole context, or Galatians 3 and develop the context. We'll spend the rest of our time. But the context of both of those passages was that the only way to be justified by the law, not under the law, but by the law, was to keep it perfectly. And to make that point, the writer quotes Leviticus 18:5. But the way to be justified by the gospel is through justification by faith in Christ. Does that make sense? You're forgiven. So could one be justified if he kept the law perfectly? Sure he could. He lives by that. That was the point. That's the point Paul is making in Romans 10:15, in Galatians 3, and in verse 12. So we don't get that on a cursory reading of Leviticus 18, but we get that when we get over to Romans 10. That if you wanted to be justified or saved by the law, you could do so if you kept it perfectly. But if you kept it perfectly, you're not justified by the law. All the law could do is condemn. We see that in Romans. You see it in Galatians. See it in Hebrews. Make sense? All right. Now with that in mind, let's shift gears now. Let's talk about uncovering nakedness in verses 6 to 18. This expression, uncovering nakedness, includes, though not limited to, sexual activity. In other words, it can involve, in some places, primarily in this context, it has to do with the sexual activity. It can have reference to discovering and seeing nakedness. Let me give you some evidence of what I'm talking about. That in this context, he's talking about sexual activity. Look at chapter 19, verses 17 and 18. Talks about a man taking his son's daughter to uncover her nakedness. He's taking her. That has seemingly a reference to sexual activity. Jump over to chapter 20. The same kind of expression is used, that he would lie with her. So there are two things that are forbidden here. So I've just quickly, and you check the New Century Version, and that'll help you with that a little bit. There are a couple of things that are dealt with in this context. The forbidding of sexual relationship with someone other than your mate. That's number one. And number two, it forbids marriage to close relationships. Does that make sense? Close relatives. So we're going to hurry through that section because we've got some ground to cover. So he says, don't uncover the nakedness of your father or your mother. Who else is mentioned? All right, your brother, your sister, the nakedness of your sister, the daughter of your father, verse 9. The nakedness of your son's daughter, or your daughter's daughter, their nakedness you shall not uncover. Now notice, this is the only time I know this phrase is used so far in Leviticus, for theirs is your own nakedness. Now, when you talk about the nakedness of your mother, that's your father's nakedness. But this is, your granddaughter is your own nakedness. And so what does that mean? I take it to mean that her shame would be his shame because of the close connection, because of the close bond to your children, your grandchildren, that her shame is your shame. In other words, you don't want to engage in that at all. Don't uncover the nakedness of your father's sister. She is near kin. Who else is mentioned? Verse 15. Your in-laws, your brother's wife, don't uncover the nakedness of a woman and her daughter. They are near kin. And let's get verse 18, nor shall you take a woman as a rival. So multiple cases mentioned here of uncovering the nakedness. Again, forbidding sexual relationship with someone other than your mate, and also forbidding marriage with someone of close kin. Does that make sense? Both are forbidden in the text. All right. Now then, verse 19, only one verse. Don't uncover the nakedness of a woman during her impurity, her customary impurity. Verse 20, don't lie with your neighbor's wife. Verse 21. Now this is interesting. Right in the middle of this, in verse 21, don't pass through the fire to Molech. Nor let any of your descendants to pass through to profane the name of the Lord. I'm your God. And so there's something implied by that. Let's first of all talk about Molech. Molech was an image, an idol that was an image of metal. You've heard described many times. It had outstretched arms and had a fiery pit below, heated red hot from a fire within the image. And children were often laid upon the arms, and they were scorched and burned and rolled off into the fire below. And so passing through the fire means you're dedicating and burning your children to this idol Molech. Well, closely connected with idolatry all through the Old Testament was sexual immorality. That's what I think is implied in this context. Now, I know it's not spelled out, but I don't think that he's talking about sexual matters, sexual matters, sexual matters. Oh, let's talk about idolatry, sexual matter, sexual matter. I think when he talks about idolatry, he's talking also about the sexual matters that went with idolatry. Because when they did that, there was the debauchery that went on with that. Make sense? All right. In verse 22, you might want to highlight this because this is something quite questionable in our day, that you shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It's an abomination. Well, we saw what happened in Genesis 19. And assuming we don't know anything else in the Bible, we know this much so far. God forbids it here, and he condemned Sodom and Gomorrah for it earlier. So homosexuality is dealt with. Verse 23 and 24 deals with bestiality. Now let's stop and flag something here because this is going to be important. At the end of verse 24 and 25 and 27 and 28, and then we'll flag chapter 20 and 23. I'll give all those verses again. What I just learned, and I am learning from the flow of this context, is the reason God's driving out the people of the land of Canaan. I think if we're not careful, we'll instill in people that God wanted to bring his people into the land of Canaan, so he just drove these people of the nation out. They were not his people, so he just drove them out because he wanted to make a place for them. He's driving them out because of their sin and their idolatry. So driving them out was not merely making a place for his people. He's driving them out to punish them for their sins. Does that make sense? And let's flag some verses that tell us that. Here's at verse 24. In other words, if you engage in bestiality, if you have a relation, sexual relationship with an animal, then you'll be like the nations that are defiled, which I'm casting out before you. The land is defiled. I will visit punishment of its iniquity upon it, the land that vomits out its inhabitants. So God pictures the land like it's a person that's vomiting the corruption out. Well, that won't be the only time the land of Canaan vomits. When's it going to vomit again? Going to vomit up Israel and Judah, aren't they? Going to do that. That's interesting. God's going to let the land vomit it up. Look at verse 25. We just got verse 25. Verse 27, we see the same thing. For all the inhabitants of the land have done, and the land is defiled. Verse 28, we see the same thing. The land will vomit it up. And you might flag 20 and 23. We'll get that a little bit later. Multiple texts talks about the reason God's driving out the inhabitants is their sin. All right. Then what we're dealing with right at the end is keep the commandments lest you die. You're going to have to keep these commandments. Don't engage in the practices of Egypt or of Canaan, etc., or you're going indeed die. Questions, comments in chapter 18. All right. He is. He mentions that time and again in chapter, end of chapter, all through chapter 18, but at the end of chapter 18, again in chapter 19. Notice in chapter 18, verse 4, I am the Lord your God. I am the Lord your God. Verse 2, verse 30, I'm the Lord your God. Again and again. I'm your ruler. I'm your master. I'm the one that gives you direction. Listen to me, not to the Canaanites, not to the Egyptians. All right, what's chapter 19 about? Various laws, I guess I ought to put it up here, that primarily focuses on relationships. I'm going to give you a taste of where we're going. We've got some ground to cover. And what I'm going to show you just simply is there's 21 separate points to be made here in chapter 19. Most of them focus on some form of relationship, like honoring the aged. Don't mistreat the stranger. Be fair and just. Don't be a talebearer. Don't show partiality, etc. And so we're going to work through those as best we can. Just miscellaneous laws, primarily dealing with relationships, how you treat people. I want to flag a couple of places, lest we forget to make this point. Let's jump ahead of ourselves to verse 14 and see the expression fear of God. I want you to be watching for the fear of God in Leviticus, and then we're going to really focus on it in the book of Deuteronomy. In Leviticus, no book says any more about the fear of God than the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Leviticus uses it in a unique way, in this sense. It uses it in contrast, as we see in chapter 19, but more in chapter 25. We're going to see it. It's used in contrast, don't mistreat people, but fear God. That's a unique use of the expression fear. And it teaches us a lot about fear. But go ahead and flag at verse 14, fear, and do it again at verse 32. And we'll make some sense of that when we get there. All right, let's go to verses 1 and 2. His point at verses 1 and 2 is, be holy because I am holy. If you're going to be a follower of God, He's holy, then be holy. What does that mean? All right, what it means is to be separated. We're going to give a contextual definition in chapter 20. So if you want to make a note to check this out later, from verse 2 of chapter 19, to go over here and flag chapter 20 and in verse 24 for a definition. We'll get that definition in a moment. But it means to be separated. God is separate from the world. He's pure. We're to be separated from the world and be pure. 1 Peter 1 quotes that concept. God says, be holy for I am holy. That's the theme of 1 Peter. You want a good commentary on holiness? Read 1 Peter. Good book. All right. Now, At verse 3, here's one of the first laws that after being holy and pure, that has to do with our relationship to God. Verse 3 talks about what? Honor your father and mother, to revere his father and mother, and keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. So there's to be reverence and respect for parents. We're going to see punishment for that in chapter 20. The next one, verse 4. Stay away from idols and molten gods, because I am the Lord your God. All right, there's two things mentioned here about sacrifice. What are they? If you bring a peace offering, it's to be of your own what? Your own free will. Yeah, bring it of your own free will. If it's coerced, it's not much of a sacrifice, is it? So bring it of your own free will. But what are the regulations about that peace offering? We've seen this previously. Okay, yeah, eat it the same day. If anything's left by the third day, you're to burn it. And so that's the sacrifice. Now then he comes back to relationships to others, verses 9 and 10. What's the rule? Leave some for the poor. So don't wholly reap your corners of your field and don't gather all your grapes. In other words, if you have your grapes, leave some behind on purpose. Don't try to get every grape there is. And the same thing in harvesting your fields of corn or whatever it may be. Leave some in the corners and the poor will have something. So God always had provisions for the poor, a way of taking care of them. Didn't overlook them. Look at verse 11 and 12. What's the next regulation? Don't steal or deal falsely or lie to one another. All those have to do with dishonesty. And you shall not swear by my name falsely. Again, dishonesty. Nor shall you profane the name of the Lord your God. I am the Lord. In other words, I'm the ruler. So listen to me. Now what else? Verse 13. Don't take advantage. Don't defraud your neighbor or rob him. And this is interesting. The wages of the ones hired, what's he say about that? Pay him that day. Don't keep it till the morning. Meaning, you have just as much obligation to pay him as he did to work for you. So you hired him and you said you'd pay him. Pay him that day. Don't keep it. I'll get you later. You take care of him. God wanted you to take care of those. Now, verse 14. Here's our first reference that we have flagged on the word fear. Though fear would apply to all the rest of these. At verse 14, you shall not curse the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind. In other words, don't mistreat the handicapped. But you shall fear your God, I'm the Lord. What did you just learn about fear? Fear means that you will, say it again, treat people right. Does that make sense? We're going to see this again and again and again in Leviticus. We'll see it in Deuteronomy, but more in Leviticus, but more references to fear in Deuteronomy. And particularly Leviticus 25. Do you ever wonder why Nehemiah and Nehemiah 5, when he came on the scene and people were exacting usury, and he said, should you not have walked in the fear of God? You ever wonder why he mentioned fear? Instead of saying, should you not have behaved properly, not exacted usury? He's quoting Leviticus 25. That's what he's doing. And so he's taking a passage that contrasts fear. If you truly fear God, you will treat people right. So show me somebody that is doing any one of these and mistreating his neighbor, mistreating someone else, or showing partiality, talebearer, abusing people, and I'll show you somebody that doesn't fear God. Fear God, everything will take care of itself. All right, we're going to see more about that at verse 32. The next one is don't show partiality, verse 15. And so don't show partiality to the poor or to the one of a high might. So you can go either direction. You say, well, I don't want to show partiality to those who are rich or those with power, but I would like to show to the underdog, show some partiality. No, don't do that either. That's being partial. So be fair. What's verse 16 about? Don't be a talebearer. Don't take a stand against the life of your neighbor because I'm the Lord. Well then, verse 17 and 18 is quite interesting. There's a couple of things we learn here that we don't see elsewhere. The point is, don't hate your brother, but love him. But we learn some things in the context. So let's see what we learn. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. Now that's interesting. We'll come back to that. Shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So don't hate, but love. But I just learned something from verse 17. And that is, a faithful rebuke is an act of love. Do you see that? Some think, oh, I love them too much. I don't want to rebuke them. I care too much for my neighbor, my children, my family, my friend, to rebuke them for that. And so I just love everybody. I don't want to cause any trouble. I don't want to stir. So I'm not going to rebuke them. What I just learned from this context, don't hate but love, but rebuke them. Rebuke them is an act of love. Now notice verse 17b. He said, and not bear the sin because of him. Now there's a question as to what that means. It can go in one of two directions. In other words, lest you become guilty. In other words, you rebuke your neighbor, lest you become guilty. Guilty of what? Maybe of, I'll get to you in a second. The New International gives one rendering. The New American Standard gives even another. The New International says, lest you become guilty, and this is not an exact quote, but here's the point. Lest you become guilty by not rebuking him at all. So rebuke your neighbor as an act of love, lest you become guilty of not rebuking him at all. The New International focuses on that. The New American Standard, which some of you may have, focuses in this direction, that you rebuke your neighbor, again, as an act of love, lest you rebuke him in the wrong way. Well, both are right. I don't know which one is what this text is talking about. Does that make see where I'm coming from? And so you do rebuke your neighbor as an act of love. Love and rebuke can go hand in hand, but don't rebuke them in the wrong way. And a failure to rebuke is showing a lack of love. Does that make sense? Powerful point to be made from verse 17. Let's go on to verse 19. Don't mix your livestock seed and materials. I'm not sure of the purpose of all of that. Some have suggested, and this makes sense, that God has, all through the book of Leviticus, is separating clean and unclean, and is driving home the principle of separation and purity of the people, that was to be a reminder of that principle. So don't mix your livestock, don't mix your seed, don't mix your materials. So don't wear linen and wool at the same time, or mix materials and make things, some garment out of linen and wool, but that keep things separate to remind them to be separate people. That must be the point. I don't know what else to make of that. Can you help me out, JP? Do you have a clue on that? Sounds good. I take that as an amen. All right. 20 to 22, don't lie with a woman that's not your wife. That's part of those sexual things we talked about in the previous chapter. Now notice at verse 20, this is quite interesting, that if it's a, let me just read verse 20. Whoever lies carnally with a woman who is betrothed as a concubine to another man who has not at all been redeemed nor given her freedom, in other words, she's not free, for this there shall be a scourging. That's King James, New King James. Yours may say something different. And they shall not be put to death because she was not free. Something about her not being a free woman suggested that she was not to be killed or to be put to death. But there was a scourging. Blackmore, in the Blackmores, which I've quoted several times, suggests there is no basis in Hebrew for the word or the concept of scourging. There's nothing in the Hebrew to suggest that. That it's more of a punishment. And they take it that the word means more of an inquiry than a scourging. That there's to be an investigation and find out what's going on. There is punishment, but she's not to be put to death. Does that make sense? And so I'll take them at that. There's nothing in the Hebrew to suggest scourging is to be in the text. All right. What's the law about the not eating fruit to the fifth year? Yeah. It's the idea of when they go into the land of Canaan and suddenly Deuteronomy 6 is going to say, you're going to have vineyards you didn't plant and trees, groves and trees that you didn't plant, etc. You're going to suddenly have it better than you've ever had it before. And so you don't eat of the first year or the second year, but by the third or fourth year, it becomes holy, and then you don't eat of that until the fifth year. I think it's because they're going into the land of Canaan. And so it's not that there's some contamination in that. It's that they were to not partake of that until the fifth year. It doesn't become holy in theirs and their right to partake until that fifth year. Well, let's see if we can finish this chapter here. We've got, seven more points to go. They're not to practice the heathen customs, verses 26 to 28. Several things that are mentioned there, such as shaving around the head, disfiguring the head. The text mentions a tattoo that probably had to do with a cutting of the skin. Probably not a tattoo as we think of it, but nonetheless, these are heathen practices that had marks on their body that suggest they were going along with heathen practices. So I don't know if really familiar with some of the modern day heathen practices, but just suppose that it was a part of atheism and heathenism to put a black X on your hand. Would it be wrong for a Christian to put a black X on their hand? You bet it would, because that's a symbol of atheism and standing against God. And so could I go do that? No, I couldn't do that. Be wrong if that's a symbol or part of the practice of heathenism. Does that make sense? That's what God's saying here. Don't get caught up in that. Let's quickly move on. Don't prostitute your daughter. Honor the Sabbath. Don't have regard for wizards. Verse 31. Consulting the dead. You might flag Isaiah chapter 8, verse 19 as a cross-reference to that. Now, verse 32 we flagged already. Rise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of an old man and fear God. Yeah. And don't mistreat strangers and be fair and just. All right. Now, I got a little behind, so I didn't get to, we're not going to have time to deal with all of this. We may have to touch on this next time. Our time is almost gone. We got about a minute to go. I do want to suggest, we'll try to comment on verse 20. I said we'd do this. Let's get ahead of ourselves down to verse 26. These are sins that require capital punishment. So I won't spend much time next time on it, but a number of the sexual sins, giving your child to Molech, consulting mediums, cursing father and mother, the sexual perversions, including everything from adultery, incest, polygamy, bestiality, etc., those should be put to death. And then finally, we come down here to this holiness being required. Here's what I wanted to flag. Look at verse 26. That here's the purpose of these laws is maintain purity. Now, verse 24, I'm just going to make one point and we're going to be done. That you shall inherit the land, and I will give it to possess the land flowing with milk and honey, who has separated, here's your key word, who has separated you from the people. Flag verse 26 to the side. Verse 26 says, for you shall be holy to me. Flag verse 24. What I just learned, a contextual definition of holy means being separated from the world. Does it involve purity? Yes, but purity involves being separate from the world. That's what these laws were all about. God wanted his people to be holy. He just told us what that meant. I want you to be separated. I've separated you, made you different. I've made you holy. Does that make sense? Contextual definition. We're going to have to stop right there.